As a public service, NPR has decided to suspend this week's political podcast so that we may read you the entire text of the Senate healthcare legislation. The clerk will read the bill.
Title 1, Section 1. 'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogroves, and the mome raths outgrabe.
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, I've never felt so relieved to hear you and me talking instead of the text of the Senate healthcare legislation.
Well, that was Eric Holder said that would be outlawed by the Geneva Accords, that would be torture having to listen to all 2,000 pages, especially on the podcast.
And yet, that is precisely what we may be doing in just the next few days if they do get 60 votes to proceed to the bill in the Senate, and then Senator Tom Coburn from Oklahoma has said he will not agree to the usual unanimous consent to suspend the reading of the actual legislation they're considering, which technically they are always supposed to do.
You do learn a lot about rules and customs of the Senate when things like this, and the Republicans have made it clear that they will delay it as long as they can, but the question is, how long can the delay go on? There's not going to be a single Republican vote, not Olympia Snowe, not Susan Collins, not Charles Percy, not Ed Brooke, not Jacob
Javits. Thaddeus Stevens?
No. But the question is, do they have the 60? I mean, Harry Reid, obviously, he's gotten the CBO number. They're a number that is apparent.
It's a mere $850 billion bargain, practically Filene's basement.
Well, that's exactly what President Obama was asking for, less than $1 trillion over 10 years.
And it actually supposedly lowers the federal budget deficit.
Because of raising taxes?
Well, there are taxes in here. We're going to tax what are called the gold-plated health care plans that some executives get and some other highly compensated individuals. There's going to be a tax on that. There's also going to be a tax on incomes over $250,000 for a couple. Wow, so that's going to be kind of close for you, isn't it? I mean,
you mean us?
Yeah.
Okay, we're not really a couple, but quick explanation to all that is that when Ken and Ron went to the White House Christmas party 2 years ago, George and Laura Bush were there greeting us. We were introduced as Ron Elving and
his partner, Ken Rudin.
I think it said that, yes.
Yeah, the meaning being partners in the podcast, but the Bushes, well, got a little uncomfortable.
Yes.
At any rate, Harry Reid's got a very tough job getting to those 60 votes, not just because 40 Republicans are saying no, that's not a huge surprise, but apparently several of the Democrats are setting the bar very high for their participation in this vote. And it's just so frustrating for the Senate Majority Leader to have a theoretical 60 votes, which we've talked about forever as being this great threshold of power, and not be able to proceed to the biggest piece of the president's agenda at this juncture, late in the first year of the presidency.
A lot of eyes are on Democrats like Ben Nelson of Nebraska, Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas, perhaps Joe Lieberman of Connecticut. I suspect, though, that they do vote to bring it to the floor. I mean, that's the key vote, and at least that's the initial key vote.
Just to bring it to the floor and apparently read the whole thing on the floor, which is going to take several days. And that would start Saturday and go into Sunday, Monday, perhaps Tuesday. Obviously, next week is a holiday week. The House isn't even in at all. So the Senate has some days to burn, and that's why they would really like to get this reading of the bill over with before they move on to actually debating amendments to the bill.
Well, Harry Reid tries to get the number 60. President Obama is in the Far East meeting with Japanese leaders, Chinese leaders, very heralded visit of the Great Wall. But accomplishments, not so much. I mean, it wasn't the cowboy kind of language that President Bush was accused of. But for all the talk about human rights and economic concessions, the Chinese weren't willing to give the United States much, it seems.
There doesn't seem to be a trophy case on Air Force One as it comes back to the United States. And the president is getting back maybe even a little bit before he was expected, getting back on Thursday night rather than Friday morning. It almost has kind of an air of, whew, I'm glad to have that behind me. I'm glad to get back to the United States. It doesn't seem to have been a triumphant first time on the Asian stage.
But he's also coming back with numbers that are not especially impressive. There's a new Quinnipiac poll that shows for the first time President Obama's job approval ratings, not his personal popularity, but his job approval has fallen below 50%. That's the first time in his presidency it's done that. And that coming off the wake of a fairly successful Republican mid-off-year election has the White House a little nervous.
Sure. And at this particular point, it's not a huge drop in the last week. The last Quinnipiac poll had him a couple of points over 50% or 1 point over 50%. So he's moved a little bit below it. But still, you're right to set it as a part of the political equation right now, because it makes such an easy touchline in the media for people to say the president is under 50 as opposed to the president is over 50 or somewhere in the 50s where he has been through most of his first year in office. So there have been a few other polls that have shown him dipping below 50. But in this particular poll, this would be his first time under 50. And I suspect that some of the others, Gallup and the Pew Research Center and so on, are going to find him going under 50 in the weeks ahead as well, because it's going to be a while, in all likelihood, before any of these agenda items comes to any sort of fruition. And in the meantime, there's a real sense of frustration among Democrats generally, and certainly among people who are backers of the president's agenda.
And if there's frustration among Democrats, there's obviously glee among Republicans. And one place where it's interesting to see what's happened to the fall, the so-called fall of the Obama numbers, is in Florida, when months ago, when President Obama was riding high, Charlie Crist, the governor, embraced President Obama when he came to Florida, the famous hug, almost like the Lieberman-Bush hug that they used against him in 2006. And Charlie Crist said that he supported the Obama stimulus program.
Because he wanted the money for Florida, which was substantial amount.
And it was popular. Now that we're talking about socialism, now that we're talking about Tea Party,
now that Charlie Crist has an opponent on the right in his primary next year.
And embracing President Obama is not as popular as it once was. This could be an albatross, perhaps, the way it was for Joe Lieberman when he hugged George W. Bush in that famous photograph in 2004 that came back to bite Lieberman in the 2006 Senate primary.
So the Republicans have had a fairly enthusiastic gathering this week in Austin, Texas, where the Republican Governors Association got together. Haley Barbour is the head of that organization, and there's a little bit of a historical irony there in that Haley Barbour was the president of the Republican National Committee back in 1993 and 1994, the last time there was a newly elected president on the Democratic side with big majorities in the House and Senate trying to pass health care. So a lot of these things all seem to have come back to us from the past.
And speaking of coming back from the past, we heard from a former vice president this week in Texas, Dick Cheney, who endorsed Kay Bailey Hutchison, who's running against Rick Perry, who is the current governor of Texas, who is being challenged by Kay Bailey Hutchison in the March 2nd, 2010 gubernatorial primary.
And that is an interesting race, because that is one of the sort of sidebars within the Republican struggle right now. The Republicans are energized by the president's problems and by their ability to slow the president's agenda in Washington. So that's the positive side, but they also have a lot of internal division. But it doesn't really seem to be particularly an ideological split between Kay Bailey Hutchison and Rick Perry in Texas.
I agree. They're both conservative. Some maybe say that Perry may be more strongly conservative than Hutchison.
On the social side, perhaps.
But it is a lot of personal stuff. Of course, Hutchison threatened to run against Perry 4 years ago, and then Perry dared her to run, and ultimately she backed out of it, won a re-election to the Senate handily in 2000.
Well, wasn't there some theory at the time that Perry had said, just give me one more term and then I'll retire. I will have already served as governor longer than anybody else in Texas history, and then I'll go, okay, and you can be governor.
That's what Hutchison's people say, and Perry denies that he's ever said that he was stepping down. Of course, he is the longest serving governor. And he also has attracted some high-profile endorsements as well. Haley Barbour and Sarah Palin both have endorsed Rick Perry. So it's going to be very interesting. And what's really hurting Kay Bailey Hutchison is, one, she promised she would resign her Senate seat. She pledged to resign either October or November. And now she says she's going to stay as senator through the March primary. And the reason is because she wants to vote against the health care, against cap and trade stuff.
And have a job if she loses the primary.
Exactly that. I mean, she says that it's no time to have a freshman newcomer senator into the Senate. Obviously, what she wants to do is she wants to keep her job.
So what is Cheney's role in all this? Why is he with Hutchison?
Well, first of all, Dick Cheney and Kay Bailey Hutchison had a relationship that goes back years when both were in Dallas. Cheney was the head of Halliburton, and Kay Bailey Hutchison, before she came to the Senate in 1993, was from Dallas, so they were good friends. But it's also interesting, I think, in the fact that Cheney is campaigning against, as a matter of fact, he called Hutchison the real deal and called Rick Perry a real talker, saying that he's not a true conservative. And yet, Rick Perry was George W. Bush's running mate, lieutenant governor.
Back in the 1990s.
Texas.
You mentioned Sarah Palin endorsing Rick Perry in that race. I think that's nice because, you know, we just don't see enough of Sarah.
No, no.
She doesn't get into the news.
No,
what's she been doing?
Well, this week she was on CSI, John and Kate Plus 8, the animal. No, she was on everywhere you could see. She was on television. A very interesting but softball interview with Oprah.
A little surprising, perhaps, because Oprah Winfrey was such a huge Barack Obama fan last year, wouldn't have anybody on from the McCain-Palin ticket. And then she was very friendly, as you say, in the hour-long Sarah Palin that she did on Monday.
Well, perhaps maybe she just didn't want to be seen as a partisan. Maybe she just wanted to open up to maybe some conservatives actually watch her program. Look, everybody watches their program. You know, I still think that Sarah Palin came off friendly. She certainly has lost none of the confidence she had, you know, that she
charm,
had in 2008. And
charm. Vivacity.
But I still found her answers on why she resigned as governor, her inability to answer the famous Katie Couric questions, what newspapers, magazines do you read?
Books, anything with print in it.
You know, it just seemed like she just, for somebody who was ostensibly plotting out a 2012 presidential race, and maybe she's not.
Ostensibly, though, you think she is, and she certainly is encouraging that sort of tease.
I do. I think her involvement in New York 23 shows that she wants to be a playa, and I think being a playa means she certainly should know more about national and foreign policy things. So I just think she has a long way to go. She does have her defenders, but it's not only the McCain people who don't like her. There are a lot of Republicans who say that she's exciting, she's charismatic, but she would be a catastrophe as the nominee in 2012.
So, of course, the reason she was on all those talk shows, including Oprah, this is all about her book.
It is about a book. She has a new book, Going Rogue, which, of course, was her nickname given to her by the McCain people. Going Rogue. When she said, when the McCain people decided to pull out of Michigan, she said, I don't want to pull out of Michigan. We have a chance there. Mm-hmm. So she was her own free agent.
She was a maverick even within the maverick team.
That's right.
And so now she's embracing that image, and she's saying that she is going rogue, saying whatever's on her mind. And the subtitle of the book is An American Life, and she does talk a great deal about her own personal life and her feelings for her husband, her children. And this is a connection to an awful lot of people. It's an over 400-page book. It is an overabundance, maybe, of the personal for some people's taste. But it's going to increase, I think, her connection to those people who have responded to her in the past.
Look, there were a lot of stories told about Sarah Palin's relationship with her children, with her Down syndrome child. A lot of it is emotional. A lot of it is personal. And I think in many ways it can connect with an overwhelming number of people.
Can I just ask you, you mentioned one thing in passing. You mentioned New York 23. Do we all understand that's not half of a football score?
Well, it's almost over, but it's going to be close. What happened, of course, election night, the conservative candidate, Doug Hoffman.
In the 23rd. Congressional District
of New York
special election.
Doug Hoffman, whose candidacy forced out the Republican nominee, Didi Scozzafava, and you know we can't go a podcast without
saying
Didi
Scozzafava.
And so he failed by about 5,000 votes to Democrat Bill Owens on election night.
Or so it appeared.
Then with some further counting, the margin was down to 3,000. But lo and behold, nobody seemed to tell Doug Hoffman as he conceded the election on Tuesday night. And of course, Bill Owens was quickly sworn in and voted.
And voted on the health care bill.
Just in time. But then it turned out there was 10,000 absentee ballots.
Whoops. Also, they had underreported some of the voting from Doug Hoffman's best county.
That's right.
So, as it turns out, the margin is much smaller. But is the result going to be reversed? Because Doug Hoffman has withdrawn his concession.
Which is exactly what Al Gore did in November of 2000.
And when he was running in the New York 23rd.
Right. And then he conceded once again in December of 2000. But the numbers are coming in. They are helping Doug Hoffman reduce the margin between himself and Bill Owens, but not enough to give him the lead. Right now, it's about 2,800 votes. There are only about 5,500 absentee ballots still to be counted. Hoffman is getting about 44% of the absentee count.
He's splitting the rest with both Owens and
right. Owens is getting 32, Scozzafava 24. That's not enough for Hoffman to take the lead. But it would have been a good story, a fascinating story had it happened.
Quick question. Do you expect Doug Hoffman to come back and seek the Republican nomination in this district for 2010?
Well, you know something? He doesn't live in the district. It was conservatives who picked them from outside the district. But I suspect that the Republicans may have learned a lesson. The lesson is you don't pick a pro-gay marriage, pro-choice candidate to run for Congress as a Republican. Once upon a time, that's exactly what you had in upstate New York and then New England, but no longer. I don't think it's Doug Hoffman, but I think the Republicans desperately want that seat back, obviously.
But if the Republicans don't nominate him in 2010, doesn't he run again as a third-party
option? No, because the Republican who will step forward will be someone far more conservative than Scozzafava.
You just mentioned a lot of numbers, went by really quickly, but there's one number I think we do need to have in the podcast this week.
Is it the number of our It's All Politics Facebook fan page?
Actually, no, I was thinking of the number of days Robert C. Byrd has served as either a member of the House or, as we know, the longest-serving senator in United States history. It now surpasses the combined total of your favorite Congressman, Carl Hayden.
As of Wednesday, Robert Byrd has served in the Congress for 20,774 days, breaking Carl Hayden's record. Robert Byrd was elected to the House in 52, the Senate in 58. He had already been the longest-serving senator in history. Now he's the longest-serving lawmaker in history. 56 years, 10 and a half months. He has cast 18,582 roll call votes. Ron is stunned.
And doesn't that pretty much put the number of people on our Facebook fan page in the shade?
As they should be.
That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. Whoa.